I'm going to read two gospel passages this morning. First from John 3, 16 and 17, and then from Matthew chapter 11. I'll read verses 2 through 6. Jesus said, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, so that whoever believes in him may not perish but have eternal life. Indeed, God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him." And then, when John heard in prison what the Messiah was doing, he sent word by his disciples and said to Jesus, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" And Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear and the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." Have you ever heard the story of Ludwig Gutmann? I really hadn't until recently. And yet we all know something about his story, and many, many of us know someone who has been affected by his story. Ludwig Gutmann was born just a year before the previous turn of the century. He became a physician. He was active in his Orthodox Jewish community and synagogue. By the time he was 34, he was clearly the highest ranking, most esteemed neurosurgeon in Germany. And he specialized especially in spinal cord injuries. But by 1933, Jewish physicians were no longer allowed hospital privileges in the German hospitals. A hospital then was developed then for the Jewish people to go to, and he became the director of that hospital. But after Kristallnacht, and once Jewish people were being consigned to the concentration camps, he was able to leave Germany and was able to immigrate to England. There he practiced as a physician, and toward the end of the war in 1944, he was asked to develop and then lead a hospital for those who had spinal cord injuries. It was the first of its kind, a hospital that treated only those who had become paraplegics and quadriplegics. At that time, the way that these young men who had become paraplegics, the ways that they were treated was to, first of all, address their pain and then to recognize just the abilities that they did not have anymore. So they were kept heavily, heavily sedated. They also remained in bed. They were typically given a life expectancy of 3 to 6 months. In fact, I just heard from our organist, Anne, that she had learned in the last few years that her own father, Don Gerdam, who many of you knew, was given a year to live when he was injured in the war. They died from infections, from bed sores, and from their original injuries. They died from pneumonia because their lungs weren't working well and they were reclining all the time. They died from other infections that came to them as well. But he had a different way of treating them. He first of all lowered their pain medicine, halved it, and that was painful, and there were complaints about that. But he knew that they couldn't do what they needed to do to heal if they weren't able to think and to function. And he had them sitting up in bed, first of all, and got them sitting up early. And as we know now, that really helps tremendously with the onset of pneumonia. and then had them moving around as much as possible, even having staff throw balls to them and back and forth. And then the throwing balls turned into some games that they developed. And then they got the men into wheelchairs, and they would play a form of basketball among each other. This helped tremendously. But then somebody in all of that activity broke a leg, which can be easy to do when you don't recognize the pain, and sometimes you don't even realize that it's happened. And there was some sort of medical tribunal there with his peers and staff. And in the midst of that kind of hearing, somebody asked him, "Who do you think that these men are?" And his response was, "They are the best of men. They are the best." So that then they deserve a future. They deserve ability to be as active as they can possibly be, far beyond what our imagination has been. And then, as we know, many, many of those who were injured then and many, many later have lived long, very full lives because of the difference in treatment that happened there at that hospital in England. And those games continued as well. It went on to be games between those who were the men who had been paralyzed and members of the staff. And the men were pretty good with their wheelchairs. They started beating the staff. You imagine how good that felt. And then he put on games between the different hospitals. And then it became an international competition in 1948. 1968, it became what many of us know as the Paralympics. And so whenever there are the Olympics every 4 years, immediately following in the same facilities are the Paralympics. In fact, when I worked in Philadelphia after college, I had a young man who worked for me who was able to get around with two substantial crutches. He had thought when he was 17 or 18, that it would be an excellent idea to jump off his roof into the swimming pool. But at that point, he had become a swimmer, a champion among those who had the same limitations that he had experienced. Touches many, many lives. Then Dr. Gutman's work in research and science continues even now, and the foundations that he founded continue to change lives, to change the world. How does healing come to the world? In the past couple of weeks, we've talked about God's salvation. We've talked about God's salvation in terms of eternal salvation from horizon to horizon of time, how we participate in God's salvation, and then what it may mean to us personally and transformation and the transformation of the lives of other people. And as I was putting together the list of the kinds of things that people pray for in their lives or the lives around them, I recognize that the things that we pray for include things that can be a work of our own spirit and our own mind or our own resolve by God's grace. But there are many others that take more than just one person changing. It takes a community. It takes churches working together, believers and non-believers. It takes governments and entities around the world to bring fuller healing, to address issues of poverty and crime and violence. Does God's salvation of the world include such things? When Jesus came in his ministry, we'd mentioned last week that his healings and his teachings were a sign not just of individual healings, but that the reign of God had come, that there would be freedom for the oppressed, that this wasn't just good news for individuals who had been freed, but for the whole world, to say that it's all been turned around, that these very best of human beings are worth healing, that they have a future. These very best of human beings will not have a poverty of the spirit, that there is good news. And Jesus was building on a strong tradition from the Old Testament, a tradition that said, as the prophets would speak of God, saying, I despise your offerings, when you bring these offerings to me, when you then turn around and then oppress the poor and the orphan and the widow and the stranger in your midst. These are the traditions that come from Amos when he said, righteousness will flow down, or justice will flow down like an ever-flowing stream, and righteousness like a river. It's what Isaiah was talking about. When Isaiah said, even the earth itself will be transformed. Animals will be changed as well. The wolf will lie down with the lamb, and the lion and the ox will eat hay together. There won't be enmity even between those beings, let alone the peaceable world all around you. And later in Isaiah, he says, oh God, that you would tear the heavens and come down. And then speaks of that land and that time that Pastor Gary read about earlier, that there will be good news to the oppressed, bind the brokenhearted, liberty to the captives, release to the prisoners, and the year of the Lord's favor, the forgiving of those who are trapped in debt. There's also a tradition in Judaism to this day that is called the repair of the world, or the invitation to take part alongside God in the healing of the world. I believe it's pronounced something like Tikkun Olam, Tikkun Olam. The repair in the world, to act in ways that lead to wholeness and maturity and healing and peace, justice and freedom in the world. It's this journey, participating in this journey of healing. And so we do this working together in whatever ways we can, like Ludwig Gutmann did. And we've seen it in many ways already in the world, and we long for other ways that we can address the problems of hunger and of war and of crime and violence and debt and bigotry. In fact, I realized I could come up with, I wrote about a list of 10 of these things, oppression and prejudice, the earth and the healing of the earth itself and health. There are story after story of progress that we really have made. It's so tempting to get ourselves down into a hole of depression, noticing things that appear to have gotten much, much worse, but to realize that there have been great strides in all of these areas when people have spoken out to protect the vulnerable, to bring pathways of reconciliation, to address even in themselves their own sense of privilege and bias, to be deeply concerned for the earth and the healing of the earth. I want to mention one story that I read about 10, 15 years ago when I was just reading a long, thick biography on John D. Rockefeller, of all people. The book was called Titan. And there was a pretty clear theme, at least clear to me in this book, that went back to John D. Rockefeller's two parents, his very kind, caring, deeply pious Baptist mother, and his father, who was literally a snake oil salesman, who went around with cures that would heal almost anything at all, who met John D. Rockefeller's mother while he was pretending to be deaf and was fleecing people in the community. His father, who had another family in Illinois. Somebody then who had these goals, these desires, this sense of salvation and a care for people that his mother had, and yet also was deeply concerned, however he could, with making a buck. And those themes went on throughout the book. John D. Rockefeller did do something amazing in a transformation of how philanthropy worked. Rather than just having a bunch of people write him and he decides whether he should send them money or not, it said that he would sit in church on a Sunday morning and just look around. People thought he was very supercilious, just looking at people like that. It said he literally was trying to figure out who might be going through a tough time right now and need some money. Well, that's a difficult way to change the world or society. So they set up a way of how can we work together and marshal the monies that we have, the scientific expertise, the social expertise, to help really address major problems. And one story that stuck in my mind was the issue of hookworm. Said it was not well known back in the early part of the previous century that in climates in the southern United States and on into Cuba and some of the other islands, about 50% of the population had hookworm. Doesn't that sound astonishing now? Hookworm is something that causes a number of gastrointestinal problems, so it causes tremendous fatigue. Well, once the scientists had done some testing and realized that the problem was that widespread, and it happened in climates where there wasn't hard freeze that didn't kill the hookworm, and also in areas where there wasn't a good sanitation and where people went barefoot quite a bit, because that's how the hookworm would be caught. And so they started a campaign to get people to wear shoes and to help people have shoes even to wear. They didn't want to increase any bias toward people in the southern part of the United States. People say, oh, that's why they all act like that. They almost completely eradicated the problem by working together, this case fairly quietly, but also through the education campaigns and through inoculations. The salvation of the world. In the Bible, there's even a number of stories where God used people who didn't even know they were being used for God's purposes. But they had that vision of salvation. When I was researching this idea of repair of the world, I came up on a sermon by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's been the chief rabbi in Great Britain for probably 25 years. And he, on speaking on this topic, he said of the Jewish people, said, our people, our religion is a protest religion. Said other religions may preach acceptance of our condition, of making do with how things are. But he said, we protest the way that things are. Even as in Job, we will protest what people will call the will of God. And we will work even to change God's mind. That we stand between the place of the world as it is and the world as it ought to be. This vision, this belief in salvation, that life can change, that it can be better for individuals and for a society and even the earth itself. So then, how do we participate in this as a church? What does that mean to us? Can we be a place of healing, to offer salvation, so that people's lives can really change? Well, first of all, I think it's extremely important that we live every day with an expectation of salvation. That which is wrong and out of place, out of kilter, it does not have to be this way. That we are blessed, that we will survive as a people. It's extremely important. When people give up, when they create their own little enclaves, even when they try to create a utopia, how are all those utopian communities doing now? They fall apart. We cannot escape what this world is. We are to be an example as well. What Jesus called a city on a hill, a light to the nations, the salt of the earth. Can we ourselves, with each other, live with reconciliation and care and support? Can we practice justice among us in our lives? And we can partner with God in the healing of the world. For there is no personal salvation without a special concern for the salvation and the healing of those around us. If we seek in our lives new insights, if we seek happiness for ourselves, there is, as the phrase goes, the door to happiness opens outward. It opens outward. We find that in the care and the love and the healing of others. couple of weeks ago, the word went out from the coach of the cross-country team of at Merrill and Callanan Junior Highs that they had a lot of kids who wanted to run in cross-country, but who didn't have shoes. They said many of these young people are immigrants, and they just don't have the resources to have these running shoes. And so does anybody out there maybe have some running shoes that still have some miles in them that they could offer? Well, I know that at least a couple of our members have gotten active in getting that word out. And Corrine told me that they've taken now 95 pairs of shoes to Merrill and Callanan and now to North High School. And North said they need some more, and now East High School as well, to have these shoes, just to have a chance for these very best of people in order to discover new ways of being, of competing, of being recognized, of just expressing the gifts that they have. This whole episode reminded me of Miss Nancy. Miss Nancy was the director of the housing project at Whitehall Common in the neighborhood in Philadelphia where I'd lived and worked. Our church, St. Thomas, occupied a corner, and then the rest of that block and the next block were these low-rise apartment buildings or townhouses. That was the Whitehall Commons. And Miss Nancy's apartment was a marvelous place of healing, of refuge. People knew that Miss Nancy would always have a hug for them. Even if they had gone off the right path, they could come back to Miss Nancy and they'd get a hug, and then they'd get a talking to and some help to get back on the right path. I visited her home one time and saw several boxes stacked up in a corner, partially blocking a door, and they were all filled with shoes, with sneakers. That was something I had to learn when I went to Philly. These dress shoes, those are shoes. Tennis shoes are for tennis, and what we might call tennis shoes, they're all sneakers, and they were all up there stacked high. And I asked Miss Nancy about that, and her response was, "No children around me should have to wait till they get to heaven to wear shoes." Now, how many of you know what she's referring to? There's a song, isn't there? "I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, gonna put on my shoes, gonna walk all over God's heaven, heaven. When I get to heaven, gonna put on my shoes, gonna walk all over God's heaven." Shoes. It seems just shoes to have that, but it's meeting a need. It is part of salvation, and it is an act of caring. A spot of heaven. Are we that? Can we be that even more? Is grace a place of healing? A place to stand up and protest against what's wrong, to protest evil, and to be the salve in salvation? When does it happen? Does it happen on Sunday night when young teenagers who are having problems relating to their own parents, but they find other moms and dads who care about them, and so the kids kind of swap families for a while, and they all feel loved and cared for, that they have a future? Is it on Monday night when periodically immigrants come and they get advice on how to find freedom through the tough tangle of the law? Is it on Tuesday night when the sick come to the medical clinic and they are healed, when they come and they have a meal that's served to them, when the hungry truly find food and care and love? Is it on Wednesday nights, those nights when the Church and Society Committee meets and they plot out how to help give a voice to the voiceless, how to help the poor both speak and hear the good news? Is it on Sunday morning where we come together and we tell these same stories about healing and about hope, where we encourage each other for another week, for a lifetime, for an eternity, and we live and act and speak and imagine that it's already here? Singing, "I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, gonna put on my shoes, gonna walk all over God's heaven. I got wings, you got wings, all God's children got wings, the very best of all. Blessed by God, those who can imagine a future, we can work together and we can see God's dream of salvation for the world. Amen.